Welcome back to Current State. It is Tuesday, the 5th of January. I'm Mark Bayshore. WKAR-TV supporters packed an auditorium here in MSU's Communication Arts Building last evening. They expressed disapproval of an option to auction the station's broadband spectrum. A Federal Communications Commission reverse auction, scheduled to begin in a few months, could result in the end of WKAR-TV's broadcast signal. I asked Ann Hansen of Ann Arbor why she attended the meeting. Here is part of her answer.
I don't like what's happening in terms of both the process as well as the thinking that WKAR could just exist in the ether or on cable, all of which are really private concerns and taking away the public aspect of PBS and WKAR.
MSU President Luana Simon has a week to decide whether to participate in the auction. Initial participation does not guarantee the sale of the spectrum. A second public meeting is set for next Monday evening. It's a Tuesday here on Current State. What does 2016 hold for Michigan's economy? Well, according to a host of experts, it mainly promises growth and improvement. That was the takeaway for our next guest when he spoke to a number of those experts recently. The encouraging assessment may mean more, considering the state trails the nation, according to several economic indicators. It all makes for some interesting trend watching. Detroit Free Press reporter Matt Dolan wrote about those 2016 trends in Sunday's edition. Welcome, Matt.
Well, thanks for having me, Mark. I appreciate it.
Who'd you talk to?
Well, we talked to a number of folks. We started at the University of Michigan and their annual economic forecast, and then sort of grew from there. They had marked a number of trends that they see annually and what the trends look like for 2016-2017, then used that template and talked to a number of business and government leaders to try to get a sense of what it might look like on the ground.
Now, before we get to the five trends that you took away from these conversations, I don't think we can underestimate the importance of car sales in Michigan's economy. We hear it time and again. Remind us how the auto sector did last year and what the projections are for 2016.
Well, that's absolutely right. I think that during the Great Recession and Michigan's so-called lost decade, there was a lot of talk about the diversification of the economy. But for whatever progress there has been made in diversification, and there has been some, the economy still relies heavily on the auto sector. What we've seen in the last year is that as fuel prices have been relatively low and that the buying public has been back in showrooms thanks to years sometimes of being away, that we're expecting record sales this year. The current seasonally adjusted annualized running rate for sales, which are being discussed by automakers today, estimate that 17.5 million vehicles, that's cars and light trucks, have been sold in the U.S. in 2015. But that's not the only good news for the industry. According to the University of Michigan's annual forecast, that number will grow to 18 million in 2016 and slightly bump up in 2017. There are still a lot of headwinds that could affect that forecast, but it could be another record year for the auto industry in 2016, at least according to the University of Michigan.
And we're seeing evidence of that rebound here in Lansing this morning. A lot of what people are talking about is the fact that one of our two assembly plants here, the Lansing Grand River plant operated by General Motors, where they make Cadillacs and the new Camaro, just announced yesterday that they'll be re-adding a third shift and hiring 500 people, quote, off the street, unquote, to man that shift. So we're seeing evidence of that here in our own backyard. So let's visit the five trends you identified. You point out that construction has rebounded. How much?
That's right. To give you an idea of where construction has been, we looked at net job gains on an annualized basis. And if you looked in 2010, 2011, 2012, when the economy was still really struggling after the crash in 2008, 2009, we saw gains of less than 3,000 jobs per year. But what we've seen is a significant uptick in that in 2013, 2014, we've seen those jobs pick up for a net gain of 7,000 jobs per year. And the news even gets better as we go forward. In 2014 through 2017, we see substantial net job gains of about 10,000 jobs a year.
Is this new home construction or public sector building or what?
That's a great question. I mean, the home business is coming back. We're really seeing a number of projects that had stalled out during the recession come to life again. You know, I think a great illustration of that is what we're seeing in Detroit, for example. My colleagues here at the Detroit Free Press on Sunday looked at all of the number of apartment building projects that are online, both in the downtown and the midtown area, and it's a phenomenal number. And what that's led to is not only a number of units to meet demand, which was already almost equal to the supply of available units, but what we're seeing is an increase in the price per square foot, which means that the developers are able to get greater return on their investment when it comes to real estate, something that, at least in terms of downtown Detroit, had been unheard of for a number of years. But with the influx of young people, especially in Detroit, we're seeing a turnaround. So that's a good example, I think, of the residential housing sector. There'll be other construction jobs as well. For example, if you look at the International Trade Crossing, the new bridge connecting Detroit to Canada, that's another public works construction project that will lead to hundreds or thousands of construction jobs. And we'll have to see, I think, in the coming years when it comes to road construction, what kind of jobs that could lead to. But, certainly if the plan holds that the state has, that's going to be a significant investment in new road construction in the coming years.
Detroit Free Press reporter Matt Dolan is our guest. He's just reported on Michigan's economic outlook for 2016, which, according to his sources, looks good. Tourism has always been important to Michigan's economy, and you're seeing tourism playing a key role in growth. Tell us about that.
That's right. We saw the comeback of this particular sector more than just in terms of the forecast for 16. We've already seen it rebound in 2015. And that is a result, forecasters say, of the overall lift in the economy, that Michigan's economy in a number of ways has come back substantially, not only in the auto sector, but in a number of other sectors as well. We see that in the unemployment rate, which has fallen significantly, and there are a number of factors certainly involved in that decrease, but it's undeniable that Michigan's economy is stronger today than it had been before. And what that's meant is that people have a little extra money in their pocket, and so they're willing to spend maybe not as much as they had in the heyday, but certainly more than they have in recent years. And what that's led to is growth in the number of tourism-related jobs. So for the leisure and the hospitality sector of the economy, we saw a rebound in 2015 to add a net gain of about 11,000 jobs. And we're looking to see even greater gains through 2017, a total of 20,000 jobs. That would be an average of about 10,000 jobs in 16 and in 2017. Mm. And that's compared to a real slip or a slump to only about 5,000 job gains in 2014, and certainly years before that may have even been less. So, it's a significant uptick. And, for example, I think we've seen places like Traverse City come back. I spent some time there this fall, and it's really a remarkable development there. And one of the indicators of how strong the economy is there and the number of jobs available is the unavailability of affordable housing. So certainly while there are benefits to in the economy as the number of jobs increase, there are also spill-on effects that have effects on other parts of the economy. And so there's going to be the need for some catch-up, at least when it comes to the affordable housing sector in that part of the state.
You write that the government sector shed nearly 100,000 jobs between 2003 and now due to the drop in property values and tax revenues, but you are hearing of a rebound, a very modest rebound, but a rebound nonetheless in 2016. Tell us more.
Right. I think it's rebound may be a little bit of a strong word, and I say that because there were so many job losses because of what happened to property values. And so I think that we continue to see economic challenging times for both municipalities, and especially for a number of school districts in the state, for a variety of factors, including how state aid works for those municipalities and for those school districts. But what we're seeing potentially for the first time in years is a small net job gain of about 600, and that's according to the University of Michigan's official forecast. But it potentially is an important breakthrough. It was interesting, after we ran our story on Sunday, a reader had contacted me that they didn't think that it should be seen as a positive. My characterization of positive was that it was no longer leading to a job loss, rather than it was positive in the sense of a net job gain.
Understood.
I think that what that points out is that a number of cities and school districts have really struggled with staffing have had a tough time doing the job that they're charged to do. So the ability to fill jobs will certainly lead to some stability in the sector, and also could potentially lead to some wage increases, although we haven't seen the kind of wage increases in Michigan, despite the number of open jobs that some economists had originally projected.
Well, that's a logical transition here to maybe a few less encouraging trends here. Let's deal with those. I'll remind our listeners we're talking with Detroit Free Press reporter Matt Dolan. He's just reported on Michigan's economic outlook for 2016, which, according to his sources, looks mainly good. But among the less encouraging trends, as we've said, manufacturing has been center stage for Michigan the last several years. I take it the growth, though, has peaked in manufacturing?
It's about peaked. I mean, the caveat that I would use here is that I think that the original forecast for 2015 had actually underestimated the growth. So I think that there has been a combination, certainly if we look to the auto sector, which is the main driver of manufacturing in Michigan still. I'm not sure that the original forecast for 2015 had anticipated the low price that we've seen of gas over time. And we've also seen that consumers are willing to come into the showrooms and spend. Part of that is pent-up demand for a number of buyers who had sat on the sidelines for years, in some cases, historic levels of sort of waiting out, meaning that the age of their cars were getting older and they were willing to stay away from the showrooms. We're seeing them come back. But because of low gas prices, we're seeing the growth in SUVs and trucks. And so that means larger profit margins for the automakers. And in a number of cases, that means a return to workers in terms of bonuses and some wage increases, although that has been a trend that's been slower to come. But when you talk about the peak, I think you're certainly right. What we're unsure about is when that peak is going to happen. According to the University of Michigan forecast, auto sales are continued to grow to record levels in 2017. But I think that there are a number of headwinds that people need to be careful about. China's economy, certainly because it's a global industry, is of great importance to the Detroit 3 automakers, as well as the volatility in gas prices. So we've certainly seen some unrest in the Middle East and the larger Arab world recently, and that could have an effect on oil prices here back in the U.S. So, you know, I think that there are just a number of factors that could play into what it means in terms of a peak for manufacturing in Michigan.
Well, it was apparently news involving Chinese manufacturing that accounted for the huge losses on Wall Street yesterday. One more question here. Another more sobering part of your story is that Michigan still trails quite a few states in some key indicators. Remind us briefly, if you can, how we still trail the pack.
Sure. Well, I think it's important to say at the outset that Michigan has made great strides when it comes to lowering its unemployment rate, to boosting its overall economy, being able to attract to some extent and retain businesses. But one of the things that is important, I think, to realize is that the losses in the state were so great, even uniquely so, during the so-called lost decade and then the Great Recession, that Michigan has an enormous amount of ground to make up. So while there may be progress, the ability for the state to rank well compared with other states is difficult. And so we look at a couple of key indicators that folks like Business Leaders of Michigan have pointed out and others as areas that the state really needs to focus on. So one of the areas is per capita income, essentially how much people are able to make it for individual and household income. And that ranks really middle of the pack or below the pack when you look at nationwide statistics. The other issue, which is of critical importance, and I talked to state leaders about this recently for a separate piece, is the educational attainment, meaning how much education folks who are in their 20s and early 30s have who live in Michigan. And that level of education by those young workers, the real backbone of our economy, is ranks below significantly other states. And that's of great concern because if for the future economy, there's a certain amount of training that needs to go on for workers. It doesn't necessarily need to be college, but it needs to be trade or college. You need to have an educated workforce. And Michigan, because of its population loss, has led to an aging workforce, an aging population, and young workers are not attracted to live in Michigan in the numbers that the state needs.
We have to leave it there. A great exchange. Detroit Free Press reporter Matt Dolan has been our guest. He's just reported on Michigan's economic outlook for 2016. Thank you, Matt.
My pleasure.
And coming up on Current State, bees are essential to many of our favorite fruits and vegetables, and it's not just honeybees doing all the work. Wild bees are also major crop pollinators. A new study suggests that the population of those bees may be declining in the U.S. We'll learn more from Rufus Isaacs, professor of entomology here at Michigan State University and co-author of the study. We'll have that story later this hour on Current State. Okay, it's the first week in January. The party's over. Time to get serious. I'm really going to do it this year. Does that sound like the dialogue inside your head, that voice that beckons you to stay fit and hit the gym? Well, a vow of better health is a common New Year's resolution. Historically, memberships to gyms and fitness clubs spike in early January. But it's also true that the numbers tend to fall off in the first quarter of the year. That's when gyms have to get creative to keep their clientele. Current State's Kevin Lavery joins me now to talk about the fitness trend that comes with the new year. Kevin, are you pumping iron these days?
Not as much as I need to, Mark, unless interviewing people with my microphone counts as a curl. I visited two fitness centers in mid-Michigan. One is a national chain. The other is a much smaller operation with three locations in Michigan, although they are planning to expand into two other states later this year. First, I spoke with Steve Zavori. He's the general manager of Powerhouse Gym in East Lansing. It's right across the road from the MSU campus, so most of their clients are students. The start of the fall semester tends to be the busy time at that specific location, but Zavori says, as a rule, January rules the industry.
Of course, I think in any gym you're going to go to, you're going to get a large influx of new members in January, just with everyone, you know, one of their New Year's resolution, and then especially it's cold outside, so no one's working out outside or going for runs, and that's no different in this gym. Of course, here we're going to have a lot more students, and so when kids come back to school, you're going to get a large influx just from that as well.
How do you get people in the door? Is it name recognition, brand recognition? Is there a pretty substantial advertising budget? I mean, how would Powerhouse compete with a similarly sized chain?
Of course, brand recognition is going to play a part in it. But especially in a gym like this, which is more of a community gym, referrals is going to be the base of your new business. You know, if you take care of your members, they're going to take care of you. And for every member that you take care of, we think they're going to bring two people with them. You know, because everyone wants to work out with a friend, especially in a town like this in East Lansing, where it's a lot of college kids, and they all want to work out with their buddies and everything like that. So we do spend money on advertising, but for the most part, it's a lot of referrals. And then, of course, it does help having a recognized brand.
We're talking with Steve Zavori, the general manager of Powerhouse Gym in East Lansing. Generally, gyms tend to see a drop-off in January. How do you anticipate that? How do you try to curb or prevent that?
Well, you know, The most important time in any membership is going to be the first 30 days. Those are days are when you're either going to make good habits and you're going to make bad habits, and that's going to stick with you for the year. So something that we do here is we offer every new member a first workout with one of our personal trainers, you know, just to get people in a routine and kind of set them up with something they can look forward to following. And then we try to engage them, you know, with group exercise classes, getting them in an 8-week boot camp program. But there's different ways to get people engaged in the gym, and you know, someone who's using the gym is less likely to cancel that membership, and that's what we try to carry out throughout the whole year.
Is your retention rate among people who come in for the new year as strong as you'd like to see?
In this gym, it's very strong. Obviously, you always want your retention to be stronger in any client-based business, but it's pretty strong in this gym.
2:15 on a Monday afternoon right after New Year's. I can probably count on both hands the number of people here. This is nothing to worry about? This is this typical or not?
This is nothing to worry about. We still have another week until the students come back. And 2 p.m. on a weekday, anyone who's not a student is going to be at work right now. So nothing to worry about.
Powerhouse Gym has some 300 locations nationwide. While an outfit like that may attract clients purely on name recognition, the smaller niche market fitness centers and studios are also trying to carve out their own market shares as they jump into January.
5, 4, 3, 2, and normal speed on the treadmill on the floor.
4 years ago, Trista Parisian and Jenny Quinn launched Flex City Fitness in downtown Lansing. They've since grown to 3 sites in Michigan. I asked Jenny how their business tries to lure the crowds away from the name brands.
Well, we take the guesswork out of fitness for people. We're a class-only studio, so we create an efficient, effective environment that's fun, and then having it all instructor-led makes the accountability there for people. So a lot of what most people struggle with their New Year's resolutions is sticking with it. So we're here to make sure that people do that, which is different than a regular gym.
I couldn't help but notice, Jenny, that you are literally 2 floors above the YMCA.
Yes, we are. It's a good relationship. I mean, we're very different than the YMCA. We are a fitness studio with classes only. We don't offer gym-type stuff. So, I mean, we're different in that respect.
We're talking with Jenny Quinn and Trista Parisian, who are the co-owners of Flex City Fitness in downtown Lansing. Memberships historically, statistically, for gyms and fitness clubs tends to really plummet, Trista, toward the end of January into February. Has that happened here, and what do you try to do to prevent that or curb that?
We have found great success all year round. Once people normally come to their first class, we offer your first class free. Normally people have jumped on the bandwagon. We offer challenges all throughout the year. We have a big challenge coming up called the New Year, New You Challenge. People who've come who have never seen the results that they're getting here, they, you know, they're amazed by it and they stick with it.
Tell me about your clientele, Jenny. I've noticed in the class that you are teaching, it's almost all women.
We definitely, because of the style of group fitness classes, tend to be predominantly female, but we do have male attendees, and we love having male attendees. We like having, our concept is designed for all fitness levels, all genders, all ages. Really, it's a, you know, open environment for everybody. It's a non-competitive, non-comparative place. The only person you're competing with here is yourself.
And again, what do you do to try to pull people, men and women, into the door, especially, again, having the YMCA downstairs and not being a name brand, a nationally recognized brand?
Well, we're trying to become a nationally recognized brand now that we have 3 locations. But, I mean, our product is unique. It's different. We are very, Tristan and I are both very experienced in health and fitness. And after we worked in it for over 10 years, we thought there was something missing. And so what we feel and we have seen from our amazing customers is that Flex is something different. It's not a traditional gym that most people have tried and most likely failed at.
Trista, how do successful gyms grow? And what are some of your specific plans for growth, especially in the coming year?
I think just keeping the accountability there, the consistency there. If you show up on Monday in Grand Rapids and you come Tuesday in Lansing, it's a completely different class. No matter what studio you go to, the community is the same. It's very welcoming. Like Jenny said, all fitness levels. We've had people who have never been able to run on a treadmill and now they're running 5Ks. You know, it's impacted every area of their life. And when health has been improved in your life, it improves all areas of your life. We have big plans for our growth. You know, we could stay as, you know, just a one studio. We're very successful here, but we named it Flex City Fitness because we feel it could go in any city, no matter where you are. And so we wanted something that you would find in a big city available to maybe some smaller cities here. So we are going to Athens, Georgia, and Gainesville, Florida. So University of Georgia and University of Florida, July and August 2016.
What makes you want to venture that far out of Michigan? That seems like an odd place, if you don't mind my saying, to set up shop somewhere else.
We've had great success with the University of Michigan State right here in our backyard. And we got approached by a developer down south, and it was just something that we couldn't pass up. The opportunity seemed great. We've had a lot of success with the college students, and we think that our studio will be a great addition to the university down south.
Can you hinge a little further forward? Your stretchy legs behind your standing knees. Hips are slightly pressing forward.
Trista Parisian and Jenny Quinn are the co-owners and founders of Flex City Fitness in Lansing. Trista, thank you.
Thank you.
Jenny, thank you.
Thank you.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And coming up on Current State, Arthur Miller's 100th birthday would have been last October. Lansing's Riverwalk Theater is just about to stage his first hit play from 1947. We'll speak with the actors and the director of the drama All My Sons. That and more after the break on Current State. It's Tuesday and time for another staff music pick of the week. Current State producer April Van Buren joins me now with one of her listening recommendations for the new year. What do you have for us today, April?
Well, Mark, I spent some time looking back at all of the tracks that got the most playtime on my Spotify in 2015. And one of the ones that really stuck out to me was the song Green and Gold by singer-songwriter Leanne LaHavas. And this track is from her latest album, Blood, which came out this summer and has been in my playlist rotation ever since.
6 years old, staring at my nose in the mirror, trying to dip my toes in the mirror, thinking, who is that girl? And does the mirror world go?
Why'd you choose this song?
I think it has a really fun, upbeat feel to it, but LaHavas still manages to infuse it with a lot of soul. And the green and gold she's referencing are actually the colors of the Jamaican flag. The song is all about reflecting on her heritage while looking ahead to the future, so it seemed like a good song to listen to as you say goodbye to 2015 and plan for the new year.
I'm looking at life unfold, dreaming of the green and gold, just like the ancient stone. Every sunrise I know, those eyes you gave to me, they let me see.
Green and Gold from Leanne LaHavas. Thanks for the suggestion, April.
You're welcome.
Meeting my guitar in the city. Feeling like a star in the city.
Current State three times daily on 90.5 WKAR. Make that twice a day on 90.5, 9 a.m. and 6 p.m. We're on every day on AM 870 as well at 12 o'clock noon. The decline of honeybees in the United States has been a hot topic in recent years. Farmers, economists, and President Barack Obama have all been vocal about the economic and ecological risks of the species' declining population. But honeybees aren't the only pollinators we should be worried about, according to a new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Wild bees are seeing their numbers decrease, too. Here to talk about why that matters is MSU entomology professor Rufus Isaacs, who co-authored the study. Rufus, welcome back to Current State.
Good morning. Happy New Year.
Same to you. Thank you. This is the first study to map the populations of wild bees. These are bees other than commercial honeybees across the United States. Talk to us about what you found.
Yeah, that's right. So this is a new study that just came out right before Christmas. And we had a team that got together from four different institutions, including Michigan State, and took data on how land use has changed across the United States. This is national level data from satellites. And then took our knowledge of how land use affects wild bee populations, and then mapped that across the country, and also looked at where the need for wild bees would be the greatest in terms of crop production. So areas where there's crops like almonds, blueberries, apples, pumpkins that need pollination from bees, and just looked at how those patterns lined up. And one thing that we found that really jumps out in this study is that the areas where there's the greatest estimated decline of wild bee abundance is also some of the areas where we have the greatest need for them in terms of crop pollination.
But we're seeing shrinking habitat. Is that the one of the takeaways?
Yeah, one of the takeaways is that there has been a change in land use driven partly by high corn prices. Farmers that produce a lot of the field crops when there were very high record prices for corn took some of the land that was in conservation programs and turned it into areas for crop production. Makes sense from an economic point of view. But that is one example. Other changes have happened where overall it's declined the quality of the land according to our estimates for wild bee populations, but also the fact that a lot of that change happened in areas that was near these pollinator-dependent crops means that we estimate there's more of a mismatch between the need for those wild bees in these crop areas and the ability of the land to provide those bees to do the pollination work.
How many different species of wild bees are there in Michigan, for example?
Well, in Michigan, we have a fairly rich community. We have somewhere between 450 and 475 different species of wild bees.
That's bees. That's not wasps, hornets.
Just bees. Just
bees.
That's
an extraordinary number. I never would have guessed that.
It is a high number, and it surprises people when they might know a honeybee or they might know a few bumblebees. But, yeah, we have a very diverse community of wild bees. And in the U.S. as a whole, there's something like 4,000 different species across the country. So really diverse group of insects, and people are studying all their biology and ecology. But there's also now a great interest in their ability to pollinate crops and the extent to which we can support their abundance on farmland is part of what we're studying here at MSU, so that we can give growers good recommendations on how they can support wild bee abundance, just to provide some, you know, some insurance. Lots of farmers of these crops use honeybees. They bring in big numbers of colonies of honeybees to pollinate in the springtime. But these other wild bees can provide some of that pollination. And in some cases, there's recent studies that show that the wild bees can actually make the honeybees work a little better as well. So there's some interactions there.
Rufus Isaacs is a professor of entomology at Michigan State. We're talking about his recent work mapping wild bee populations across the U.S. Your study focused on habitat loss as a predictor of wild bee populations, but are there other threats to those species besides habitat loss?
Yes, there are. There have been some reviews of what's known in the literature that highlight habitat loss is a big part of this, but then there's also potentially increases in the level of diseases. So bees get diseases just like humans get diseases. And there's some viruses and bacteria, fungi that can attack them. And so some of the surveys have shown elevated levels of those certain diseases in wild bees that correlate with declining abundance. And it's interesting that there's a link there too, where bees that are in habitats that have a rich source of pollen and nectar from flowers tend to be more resistant to diseases, just like there's a link in humans' nutrition to disease. So it's similar in bees. And so there may also be interactions there between disease and habitat quality. But also pesticide exposure has been in the news a lot as a potential additional cause of stress in both honeybees and wild bees.
What crops are most at risk from declining wild bee populations?
So in our analysis, in this current study, we highlight crops where the abundance of them is increasing and where that's happening in areas where we're predicting that the wild bee abundance is lower. So those would be crops like blueberries, apples, cherries, pumpkins, almonds. So crops that wouldn't produce a commercial yield unless they had a good supply of bees. And that's provided in commercial farms both by honeybees and wild bees. But this analysis just focuses in on the wild bee component.
But could a decline in the wild bee population be supplemented or be compensated for by importing honeybees?
Absolutely. Yeah,
that's how growers are responding to this challenge?
That's how growers have responded already. I mean, in the larger areas of production of these crops, such as the Central Valley of California, there are literally millions of honeybee colonies that go there in February and March to pollinate almonds and then other crops. So this is already, the system is already set up in this country where beekeepers meet that demand from the growers. But what we're saying here is that if these trends continue, then those crops will become more and more dependent on honeybees. And with all things, it's good to have a diversity strategy.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, diversity is a good idea.
How would farmers know whether or not their crops are getting enough pollination? Would they mm-hmm. would they notice a significant bee decline, for example?
Well, you might not notice it in an individual year, but we've had springs here. I'm sure people listening remember 2012, where we had 80 degree weather in March, and all of a sudden those flowers from those crops were in bloom, and we had poor pollination that year because of early frost damage, and people really noticed it that year. So it's not going to be that extreme. You wouldn't see that level of decline or loss of yield. But growers have ways of testing their crop. They could cut open an apple and look for the number of seeds. They could do the same with a blueberry. Those kinds of techniques can be used to estimate pollination.
Briefly, Rufus, talk to us about the ways that we might combat the loss of wild bees.
Well, there's a number of programs that the federal government has invested in through the Natural Resource Conservation Service that's part of USDA. And so farmers can actually, in some parts of the state, they can get a very good payment to establish habitat on their farms for pollinators. So there's some hoops that you have to jump through. But there is now funding as part of this focus by the government, as you mentioned at the beginning, to support pollinator habitat, putting that back into farms.
Rufus Isaacs is a professor of entomology here at Michigan State University. We've been talking about his recent research, mapping the decline of wild bee populations, and there are many more species of those than you probably imagine. He's been mapping those populations in the United States. Rufus, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This segment is supported by Michigan State University's Knight Center for Environmental Journalism. More news about the Great Lakes environment can be found at greatlakesecho.org and on Current State every Tuesday as part of our partnership. Well, last October marked the 100th anniversary of the birth of American playwright Arthur Miller, and the Riverwalk Theater of Lansing is about to mount a production of one of his early plays, All My Sons. Current State's Jamie Paisley joins me now. Jamie, when's the last time the Riverwalk put on an Arthur Miller play?
Well, according to one of the cast members I spoke with, it's been about 20 years. And so, as you said, the Riverwalk chose 1947's All My Sons for this season, the first big commercial hit for Arthur Miller. Although, in speaking with the director of the upcoming Riverwalk production, Bob Robinson, it's quite possible that it could have turned out to be Miller's last play.
This was a do-or-die project for Arthur Miller. He thought that he wanted to be a playwright, but if he couldn't make it with this play, he'd be looking for something else.
And then going on to a novelist.
Yes, yes. So he wrote All My Sons, and used themes in it that later became fairly common to his works. Miller was sort of a leftist-leaning individual, and in fact did testify before the McCarthy Committee, the House Un-American Activities Committee. Miller liked to use small groups to demonstrate what he considered to be the oppression of either government or big business or society in general of the small individual person or small group. The Keller family here is examined post-World War II in 1946, and the play deals with things that happened during the war and the consequences of those things and how the Keller family has to deal with the demands of society, how it deals with deceit and greed and love and courage and social responsibility and moral responsibility. So like most good dramas, this play challenges us to examine a lot of the really serious and important themes in our own lives, how we deal with people as individuals, and how we as members of society deal with our responsibilities to society.
We talked earlier about the Miller being brought up before the House of Un-American Activities, and this is a play that predates that. So do you think that this play was an attack on or just kind of tearing down of the American dream at the time?
Well, I think so in a way, because part of the play is a blame focused on society for demanding so much of its citizens. And society at that time obviously was the government. And this play is based on a real story. And Miller viewed that as being a challenge to an individual by society to do more than perhaps he could do. And if he didn't do what he was supposed to do or what government wanted him to do, in this case the Army and the Army Air Corps in manufacturing airplane parts, if he didn't do it, he was going to lose his business. And Miller saw that as being totally unfair for government to say, yes, here's your contract to build these airplane engine cylinder heads, but if you don't do it perfectly day in, day out, every day, and deliver every day what we need to have delivered, we're going to jerk your contract and ruin your business of 40 years. So I think that there was more than an implicit criticism of government at the time. I think it was a direct criticism of the military and the way the government and the military treated its own citizens here at home.
The central figure to the play, All My Sons, coming to the Riverwalk Theater, is Joe Keller. He's the head of the factory and of the family who finally faces the repercussions of decisions made years prior, questionable decisions that helped him become, frankly, a rather comfortably wealthy man. Playing Joe is Michael Hayes, and with Joe's dilemmas taking center stage in All My Sons, I asked Michael a basic question. Would Michael Hayes, the actor, like Joe Keller, the character?
Yes. I think first and foremost, yeah, that's important. And actually, just so you know, I mean, I think that regardless of what character you're playing on stage, you have to find some element of liking the character. Now, I don't want to be overly political, but for example, I once played Dick Cheney, so that was a challenge. But Joe is very likable. Unfortunately, he has made some errors, one of which is, you know, highly important to this particular script. But even that error was an error of trying to do what he thought was best for his family at the time. I mean, he's a really down-to-earth guy, salt of the earth, I like that expression, and he just happened to have made some mistakes, one of which costs him more dearly than any other mistake he made. So, very likable guy. I mean, and that's, you know, there's additional characters in the play that are intended to bring that out of Joe. You know, there's a young boy named Bert who Joe messes around with him and tries to tell him there's a jail in the basement of the house and all this, you know. And so he plays with the neighborhood kids, and he's a very popular guy. So, yes, he is likable.
And for actor Michael Hayes, that likability also lends itself to sympathizing with the other more universal messages of this post-World War II drama coming to the Riverwalk.
That's one of the strengths of this play, even though I didn't really recognize the revolutionary aspect then, but I have always recognized the universality of this piece, that there are certain phrases that Joe Keller has which are very current today, one of which is, as you mentioned, the rise of the military-industrial complex, which to me is, you know, far before Afghanistan, far before Iraq wars. I mean, those are the most recent and, to my mind, the most harmful activities that have taken place from our government. But many people could say that every single war is a byproduct of profit, that there are individuals who promote war so that they can, you know, gain enormous amounts of money or power. I mean, so it's really a question of what is the true motivation behind any war. And I think really, if you track it down, other than, you know, for example, in my mind, again, I'm not a historian, but, you know, our involvement in World War II appears to have been a very necessary maneuver, because there you had a tyrant who was, you know, slaughtering millions of people. And sometimes our motivations for going to war are not so clear-cut as that. And I'm not even certain that, you know, there weren't also some other factors involved in that war. I mean, there's a thing about everybody getting so educated. I'm trying to think of my line now. Pardon my language, but it's in the script. Everybody's getting so goddamn educated, there'll be nobody to take away the garbage. Okay, so that's a great line. And if you think about today's battle over minimum wage, which I'm in favor of for whatever reason, but, you know, at some point, when do we over-educate our public, and when do we overtrain and overpay our public? And then there is nobody to do the more menial tasks. Now, you know, you never want to have disregard for a person who has those jobs, but certainly those jobs need to be filled as well as any other job. So there are many elements of universality in this play.
Joining Michael Hayes as Joe in the Arthur Miller play All My Sons at the Riverwalk Theater for the next couple of weekends is Jeff Magnuson as Chris Keller, Joe's son and heir apparent, particularly as Joe's other son, Larry, remains missing in action from World War II.
Chris feels that both of his parents are caught up in the past, and one of the dynamics of this play that I find so intriguing and important is that sometimes families don't tell each other the truth.
Right.
We don't want to hurt each other's feelings. We don't want to cross boundaries that have been established for years. We don't want to butt up against roles that everyone plays. And Larry being missing has been very complicated for everyone. It's a very delicate dance that we do around our grief, but we haven't been able to fully grieve his loss. It's a very complicated dance. Really, it's hard to find those ways to move things forward as a character when everyone else seems stuck in a certain mindset. My character challenges everyone, though, to move forward into the future. Let's take the next step forward. Let's close the page. Let's find a way. So really, my character sets the dominoes in motion, and yet it's not always entirely clear in this show who's a protagonist and who's an antagonist. We all take that piece for each other sometimes and find ways to move the story forward.
Everybody's the hero of their own tale.
Absolutely. And Arthur Miller is fabulous at that, whether it's The Crucible, whether it's Death of a Salesman, whether it's his more modern or lesser known plays. He always writes that way. He gives every character a fully vested role in moving the story forward in a really intriguing way, in my opinion.
In addition to portraying Chris Keller in All My Sons, Jeff Magnuson has another role advancing the story of the Riverwalk Theater itself as president of the board.
I understand that about a day ago, news was released of something new coming to the Riverwalk Theater. What is that new item?
Absolutely. Last week we learned that LEAP and the City of Lansing have given us a very large grant in cooperation with the REO Transportation Museum and Impression 5 Science Center to create a piece of art out at our entrance. We haven't figured out exactly how to make all of that work, in conjunction with another grant that we've recently secured from the Pentecost Foundation. Thank you to our dear friend Bob Malore, who's been a part of the organization for many decades. We're going to have a new marquee for hopefully the north side of the building as well, so it'll allow us to be more visible from Michigan Avenue as well. We're going to tie all of this together. We're very excited. The Arts Council of Greater Lansing was critical in facilitating all of this, and can't say enough how great grateful we are to have those opportunities to continue to be a part of downtown Lansing as we continue to grow for the region.
Bring in as much pedestrian traffic as we can, too.
Love it. Absolutely love it. You better believe it.
While the marquee and statue aren't there quite yet, the Arthur Miller drama All My Sons opens at the Riverwalk Theater this Thursday and runs this weekend and next. Tickets and more information about the post-World War II drama is available at riverwalktheater.com. For Current State, I'm Jamie Paisley.
And that's our show for today. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, imagine you're locked in a room and need to work with your companions to figure out how to get out within an hour. Well, if that sounds like fun, then Escape 2020 in Okemos is for you. Current State Scott Pohl has the story. And the City Rescue Mission of Lansing is a nonprofit that strives to meet the physical and spiritual needs of men, women, and kids struggling with homelessness. Over the last year or so, they've made changes and they've expanded their services. We'll speak with City Rescue Mission Executive Director Mark Criss and Randy Barton, Director of Men's Ministries. That and more tomorrow on Current State. We are glad you could join us today. We hope you can join us Wednesday. It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore.